plan in place to hire teachers to leave their jobs, their state paid jobs, lovely pension jobs, to come and work for us full time. And because we had about 30 teachers working for us in the evening times, we approached 10 of them and said, do you want to leave your school and work for us full time? And all 10 of them said yes.
Wow.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Fox. This week, we have a first on the podcast. We're interviewing someone who woke up one day and said, I'm going to start a school from scratch. This week, our guest is Chris Lauder, the founder of Dublin Academy of Education. And it really was a different, very different interview for the podcast. Chris is someone who's taken a very, very, very traditional industry. Very few schools have been opened in Ireland over the last 100 years. He's taken a very traditional industry and just completely turned it on its head, taken an entrepreneur's view to something that has been around for hundreds of years and completely changed it, improved it, tweaked it, and made it his own, and has had explosive success in the last 10 years. It's a really interesting interview. And as we're going through, listen to the figures and facts that Chris is talking about, because he's quite relaxed in how he presents it, but his business growth has been phenomenal. I loved his journey of how he just literally started with a problem that had been in front of his face all along and just grew and grew and grew and solved each problem as they faced, and now has a brand new facility in Stillorgan. I took a tour around it just before he started, and it's definitely not like Nina CBS. It is a state-of-the-art facility. It's more like walking to Google or a high-tech company here in Dublin. You just walk into someone or into somewhere and you get a feeling of somewhere instantly, and it just felt relaxed but yet professional. It's an incredible place for people to be able to go and do their secondary education. So without further ado, here's this week's guest, Chris Lauder. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Gary. Pleasure to be here.
I don't usually start off like this, but just tell us where we're sitting.
We are sitting in the former server room of an old office, which we've now converted into my office, and it's in our school building here in Stillorgan, South Dublin.
Yeah, it's the first time I've come and someone's built a school from the ground up. So we'll just tell us a little bit about the school and then we'll jump back to how it started.
Okay, so it is called the Dublin Academy of Education. We're now in our 10th academic year here. The school itself consists primarily of kind of two aspects. The first aspect is it's a part-time grind school for people, you know, from first to sixth year who need a little bit extra help with, you know, work for the state exams. So we do once a week, they come for grinds to us for 75 minutes in up to 23 subjects. So that's happening in the evening time. We've got about, I think it's 98 classes a week running, Monday to Saturday. We also do revision courses at Easter and May and all of that. So that's one part of it, is the part-time. The second part of the bit at the school is our full-time aspect. So we run courses for fifth and sixth year here full-time at the Dublin Academy of Education. So i.e. you can leave your school, come to us full-time, and the whole idea is that we have some of Ireland's most passionate and dedicated teachers here to teach students, you know, and help them realise their full potential, both academically and personally, for the Leaving Cert.
I've met a lot of entrepreneurs. No one has ever went and set up a school.
It's a funny one. It's a funny one. Like a lot of things that happened by accident, myself and a friend of mine set it up straight out of college. So kind of going back a little bit, when I was filling out my CAO in 2006, like a lot of people, I didn't have a clue what I wanted to be. And what's funny is you ask students to fill out this career shopping list, and they have no idea what they want to be, and they get kind of advice from guidance counsellors who don't know them on what they should be for the rest of their life. Now, I was good at maths, I liked Lego. I thought, give engineering a go. And my dad actually really encouraged me to do that as well. He said, it's a great degree to have, helps you with problem solving, and it's a really good platform for launching yourself into the future. And also, he was running a family business, him and his brother. And it was always said to me growing up that, Chris, one day you're going to go into the family business and kind of take things over with your siblings and cousin. And that was kind of my safety net. That was kind of the preordained path that was laid out ahead of me. It was, Chris, go to college, become an engineer, and go into the family business, which was in chemical distribution, which is a very exciting area. I could have you here all day talking about it. So I went into engineering. I thought I'd be building skyscrapers, designing bridges and sexy things like that. And it was nothing but maths for 4 years. And I found it really, really tough. Didn't really find the lecturers engaging. I thought it was very loosely put together. And And I realised pretty quick that engineering wasn't something I wanted to do the rest of my life. And always in the back of my mind had this idea that, look, just get through the degree. Get through the degree, and when you come out, you'll just go into the family business and you'll work away there, and that and life will be great. And well, I got to my third year in civil engineering. It was about 2009, and the recession, the big dark scary thing that had descended upon the world in 2008, had really hit Ireland big time. And unfortunately for our family business, that went under in the recession very quickly. And so all of a sudden, my kind of backup plan, my safety net, was pulled from under me, and I realised, oh God, what am I going to do? I've got to pivot massively here. And a friend of mine from engineering, a guy called Brian, had a similar fate, family business background, that went under in the recession as well, and he didn't want to be an engineer. And we said to each other, okay, let's start a business when we leave college. Let's just start a business, okay? And we went into our fourth year of engineering, scraping by, like, I don't know how we got into fourth year even, and we spent all of fourth year thinking of business ideas rather than studying engineering things or going to engineering lectures.
Give us a flavour of some of the mad ideas you came up with.
Okay, so one of them was getting slot machines, you know, those kind of gaming machines.
Yeah.
So we like went up north and looked at them and tried to buy them, like, on done deal and all sorts. So we figured out there's, like, massive legislation involved, so that was kind of kicked to the curb pretty quick. We looked at setting up a kind of like, remember Groupon?
Mm.
So we
that was
were
all
like,
the flavor
we were
back
like
then,
Groupon,
yeah.
It's going to be huge, man. So we came up with an idea to set up like a Groupon for weddings.
Okay.
Right. So
people, okay, yeah.
You know, a lot of people
you
get married,
that.
20-something thousand people a year. I still remember the stats. Or is it? I can't remember that. Maybe not. Anyway, we set up a wedding website, got it designed in India, you know, the whole shebang, and then it just flopped. That didn't work. We wanted to do like advertising on taxis. That's actually now a thing.
Yeah.
We wanted to advertise on bins. That's also now a thing.
Yeah.
But none of this stuff worked. So
you had a wide range. You were just, you did yeah. completely wide range.
We were looking around us going, okay, yeah. what need, like, where's our gap in the market? And we saw lots of things, but they weren't really gaps that we took action on, you know, maybe the right types of actions to fill. But what's funny is, and I was saying this before we turned on the podcast, was that often the best idea is right in front of your face. And it's like that book The Alchemist, which I'd recommend people read. It's when we were in fourth year, Brian was going around on his motorbike. Brian was exceptionally good at maths, exceptionally good at teaching maths. And he was doing about 15 one-on-one maths grinds a week on his motorbike in the evenings on Monday to Friday.
While he was in college. Right.
And I said to him one day, we had a conversation, and it was around, you know, why are you doing them one at a time? Would you put them in a room and conduct a class? And therefore, you could do all of them at once. And he said, you know what? I've thought about it, but I haven't got around to it yet. And I said, well, how about we set up that when we leave college? How about we set up a math school? And he said, let's do it. So we somehow scraped through fourth year, got the degree. It's actually on the wall there. Never used it once. I just put it up there for the laugh.
A reminder
of 4 years of my life that I'm never getting back. But we came into college in May of 2010. We spent that summer kind of putting together the plan for the math school. And we said to ourselves, okay, we can't just be like Brian and Chris's maths school. It has to be called something kind of prestigious and sound like it's been around for ages.
Mm.
So we called it the Dublin School of Maths. We thought that sounded nice.
Sounds
it sounded
legit,
quite official,
yeah.
legit, but it was basically two young lads who had no idea about education at all. They had no contacts in education. We had no experience in education whatsoever, but yet we were starting a school called the Dublin School of Maths. And what was interesting was, as I said, the family business went under in the recession, but we actually took the logo and we just repurposed that. We changed the name from my dad's company's name to the Dublin School of
Really?
Maths. And we got it done for about €20, you know, on Fiverr or whatever. It cost 20 in the end. But so that was our logo. That was a nice little reminder as to why I was starting it, you know.
Oh, that's
and I can talk about
yeah.
that as the importance of a why. But it was all about rebuilding. You know, Brian's family had lost their business in the recession, and so did we. And we were coming together to rebuild something new, you know, start again. And I remember we literally went to a power centre in Cabinteely. We said, how much to rent your rooms? The rooms were about the size of this, let's say 15, 20 square metres. And I think there were €25 per hour to rent the rooms. So we booked in two nights a week. We then went and we had to obviously launch a marketing campaign. Mm. Now, myself and Brian had €500 each between us, so our seed capital was a grand.
Okay.
So 500 quid so was still, yeah, that's all we had.
It's not a huge amount, but it's enough to keep going. Yeah,
it was enough. So what we did was, we literally didn't have any money to pay a graphic designer, so we got out Microsoft Word and we made a flyer in Microsoft Word and we went to a printer and we printed, let's say, 1,000 of those flyers, and we drove around every single post office, supermarket and petrol station from Ballsbridge to Bray, and we put up flyers everywhere. And advertising, Matt's Grinds were starting in Cabin TV Power Centre on the first week of September 2010. And the good thing was, Brian was had a really good name for himself in Cabin TV because he'd been doing grinds for a number of years there. So when we got the word out to kind of those people, that helped give us kind of a bit of a, you know, a starting point. But then we also had people who saw the flyers, called us up, and I remember in our first week, we'd worked out we needed like 27 people to break even in terms of paying for all of the rent that we had, the kind of the marketing with the phone bill, which that was funny. We didn't want to be a mobile number, so we rung up, let's say, I think it was Air at the time, Aircom, and we bought a number, 01442 4442, right?
Which was that still credibility, was it?
Which is still our number today, 442 4442, and we redirected that to like an old Nokia 3210. So if someone rang the number, it looked like it was ringing an office. It was really just ringing a Nokia in my pocket.
Right.
And anyway, launched the first week, 28 people turned up, and we'd broken even from day one, which was great. Yeah. Okay, when I say broken even, like, we're talking about tiny amounts of money here, really. But to say, but it's quite a significant milestone. What really helped that, Brian had that bit of reputation, which really launched it. And we really realised after, let's say, about 3-4 months, that Brian was special. He was a phenomenal teacher. And people started signing up. They really, really did. You know, we went from 20 kids, 28 kids in our first week, and we finished the first year with about 50 or 60 students. So it was okay, modest enough, but we knew the service was great. And one of the things, though, one of the biggest challenges was, and education's a big one for this, like any industry, is reputation, right? It takes 20 years to build a reputation and 5 minutes to lose it. But in education, reputation's everything. And the problem was, people would ring us up, and I'd answer the phone, the old Nokia, and they'd say, yeah, I've never heard of the Dublin School of Maths before. Why would I send my kid to you and not to Leeson Street? Why would I send my kid to you? And I'd be there, you know, a young lad, I was 21 maybe at the time, and trying my best to sell the concept of the school to them. But I'd say in about 60 or 70% of the phone calls, it wasn't working, okay? And they weren't coming through the door. So at the end of the first year, we kind of said, okay, you know, we know it's good. We just need to, we need to shake things up a bit here. We've got a great product, all right, but we're not marketing it well. Now, if you're not marketing your product, you know, it's just not going to go anywhere, okay? And actually, in our first year as well, we were also a little bit distracted because I was working on a building site lifting blocks, and Brian was working in a shop in a greengrocer's.
Okay, right? So you were paying the bills
that way. We were funding things. So I actually rented a house in Middletown with my mates, and then yeah, we had expenses, right? Yeah. So rather than get a job in engineering and get kind of sucked into a career there, we just said, look, let's just do kind of jobs that won't suck us into, dare I say, the rat race.
Okay. So that was a conscious decision.
Okay,
that's interesting.
Do something that just pays the bills, but we know that our focus is going to be the school. Maybe end of the first year, we quit those jobs and we said, no, we're putting everything into this school in year two now. And we said, okay, the issue is, the challenge is, people don't trust us. We need to get them in the door. Once we get them in the door, they're going to love it.
Okay.
How do we do that? Okay. And I remember we were kicking things around for a while, and Brian just goes, let's just give it away for free. And we kind of went quiet for a second. I'm like, free? That's genius. Because people can't say no to free stuff, particularly mothers, right? Now, there's obviously a catch here. The whole idea was that people were reluctant to pay us €1,000 or €900 for a year of grinds because they'd never heard of us before.
Oh, you'd pay up front, did you, for the whole year?
Well, or you could pay by installments as well.
Okay.
But the problem was that people were afraid to pay in case it didn't work out. So we said, okay, let's give them a chance to see how good it is, experience the teachers, see the notes, get a, you know, an idea as to what the service could mean for them and how it could help them. So we designed this free 3-day maths course before the school year started.
Okay.
So in August, students could come along for free for 3 days and see Brian, the maths teacher, in action and see how good he really was. So when they walked out of that, the whole idea is that they're like, wow, that was brilliant. I can't do without this. This is a great product. This is a great service. And I remember we had no money, nothing, right? And we said, okay, let's do a big marketing campaign, free 3-day maths course. Let's drop a flyer into every door in Dublin. Right, and it was actually South Dublin really where we started. So every door in South Dublin, and we needed 15 grand to do this, to print the flyers and pay a company to deliver them, right? And for us, like, we turned over, let's say, 25 grand in our first year, very modest turnover, and we were about to spend 15 grand on a marketing campaign for a free course. And it was, you know, 2/3 of our turnover from the previous year. Didn't have the 15 grand, to tell you that much. So we designed up a business plan, which I think are a waste of time anyway. But we designed up a business plan. We put on our best suits from, I think it was our Deb suit. And we went down to, I won't say what bank it was, but they weren't backing Brave at the time. Let's say that. Okay. And we went down to this bank and went into them and said, okay, we want 15 grand for a free maths course marketing campaign. And they said, sorry, what? You want to borrow 15 grand for a free course? Well, you know, are you not going to charge them something like 10 euro, 20 euro, something? Like, no, it has to be free, because then you get loads of people in the door. At the end of it, then they can sign up to a year's worth of grinds, which is going to cost 900 euros.
Yeah.
And they were like, well, has anyone ever done this before? And we said, oh, no one's ever done it before. Well, how do you know it's going to work? And we're like, we just believe it's going to work because we know our product's good. And if people experience it, they'll know it as well. So then they're going to sign up. So I remember the bank literally laughed us out of the branch. They said, look, guys, forget it. You know, come try it out and come back to us and see if it works. But we're not going to give you the loan. So we rejected the loan. And we kind of picked up the phone, friends, family, and so on. And we raised the 15,000 that way. And people who believed in us kind of backed it. And I remember, spent the money on the flyers. They went out and the phone exploded.
Really?
It literally blew up. People ring up going, free 3-day maths course. What is the catch? Is this a scam? Are you going to kidnap me? Am I going to be robbed? Why is it free? And, you know, I was there going, no, it's just to give you a chance to try out the classes, see how good it is. And we had loads of value in the 3 days. And we did. It wasn't just, you know, a sales pitch.
Yeah.
Where
3 days is substantial. There's a lot.
Huge amount covered in that. And people just said, okay, great. And we got 300 people to turn up to the free courses.
Had you a figure in mind? Had you a number of people you wanted to get in mind?
It was, we didn't really have a clue what we were going to get, but we planned to get a lot of people.
Right.
In hindsight, we probably built it for about 250, 300, 400 people in that kind of ballpark. And we got 300 people to sign up. Now, the beauty of it was, as more and more people signed up, we just added extra classes to cater for the demand.
Gotcha.
That makes sense. So it was quite, you know, kind of dynamic like that. It was easy just to go, yeah, put on another course there. And
was Brian still doing all the teaching?
He was. And when I say 3 days.
I say he was looking at the phone.
Yeah. He was like, oh, Jesus. And so we added courses on, and 300 people turned up. At the end of the 3 days, 150 of them signed up.
Wow.
So in our first year, we had 50 students spend the year, and we started year two with 150 students. And we turned, you know, the 15 grand into probably about 10 times that.
Yeah.
Paid back the people the next day that we borrowed the money from. And we were like, okay, we've got our model.
So people would pay up front for the year.
Or an installment.
Yeah.
So, you know.
But you knew you were getting that money back.
You know you were going to get it. They were signing up for the course for the year. So we were like, okay, we've got our model here. It's great teaching plus innovative marketing equals student numbers. And I remember we finished our second year then with about 250 students. So we grew about 5 times from year one to year two. And at the end of year two, people said to us, why are you just doing maths classes? Would you not do Irish and French and English and so on? And we spent all of the summer of our second year going, okay, well, if we're going to add on extra subjects, we have to make sure the quality is as good as the maths, because otherwise people just go, oh yeah, the maths is good, but everything else is rubbish. So we spent that whole summer looking for more teachers to come in and help teach those other subjects. And one conscious decision we made was, okay, we don't care about making any money on this. Our primary focus is quality, okay? And now we're going to focus on getting market share, giving value, and then we'll worry about profits down the road, okay? So we offered big money for people to come in and teach these other subjects. Okay. Now, we looked at what was the market rate by the kind of main competitors out there. What were they paying? Okay, let's just pay even a little bit more than them, okay? And we put that out there into the kind of second.
I was going to ask, how do you find great teachers?
It's amazing. It's a lot of it's kind of espionage. It's kind of like, you know, how do you find entrepreneurs for your podcast?
Yeah.
It's kind of talking to people. It's kind of like getting the word out. And we did a lot of that. And if you know one great teacher, they'll know five more.
That's what I always said. If you interesting people know interesting people.
Yeah exactly. And great teachers know other great teachers.
Yeah.
And word did spread. And we had lots of people come and interview for the jobs. And we didn't just, and what's funny, like me and Brian were about 22, 23 at the time. And these people would come into us, and some of them had written textbooks, some of them had advice for the curriculum and had 30 years experience. But none of that mattered to us. We said, teach a class to us. Okay. And we'll sit there and watch it. Because the only way to know if a teacher is a good teacher is to watch them teach.
Yeah.
Okay. You can have all the accolades you like, okay, but unless you can prove it, you're only as good as your last class. So unless you can prove it in the classroom, that's the only way to know if you're a great teacher. And like some people gave us two fingers and said, like, how dare you?
Really?
These two young lads thinking they can ask me. And
that's a sign in itself, though.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas the teachers who are confident in their abilities go, absolutely, come right in. You can see me. I have nothing to hide. And spent that summer. And we didn't start off with every subject. We added in Irish, English and French. And we started off with those. And, you know, we got some really good teachers in teaching those. We didn't get all perfect teachers. You know, you can't build a wall with perfect bricks. You know, there's always a few in there. But we had great, great teachers for the most part. And I remember we started our second year with about 1,000 students. We literally went from about 250 to, and then, yeah, I think we actually started, with about 500, and then by Christmas time, we were up to 1,000.
Okay. I'd imagine it's one of those things that word of mouth is huge.
It's all word of mouth.
If kids are in school, they're doing really well. What are you doing? What's changed?
Yeah, and all in this time as well, it was myself and Brian who started out, but then Brian's brother, a guy called Tom, he'd actually dropped out of college, it wasn't for him, and he joined our team. So the three of us kind of set out on the journey then to grow this together. And we finished our third year with about 1,000 students. We're like, whoa, we really have something here. Mm. Now, the things were going great, definitely, but we had other problems. Problems came in the form of venues. So as I said, we started off in a parish centre. Mm. And it was great for the first year and a bit of the second year. But when you start going from 100 kids to 1,000 kids a week, like, you have a lot of logistics going on there and space requirements, and we were just outgrowing places like crazy. So every single year we had to move. We went from a parish centre to kind of two parish centres to a hotel and two parish centres. One stage we had three venues running at the same time, all in South Dublin. And then we went to a primary school and then to a secondary school. In the last 10 years we've moved, I think it's 8 times.
Right.
So, you know, that was a massive challenge for us. And so as I said, it was, you know, it was the three of us, then we hired all the teachers, but then we started to have to start hiring admin staff, people to answer the phone. We had to hire operations staff because we started printing like a hell of a lot of notes. Like, we were running this from a home office.
Okay, so you're evolving into a whole school, effectively a virtual school.
Yeah, well, it was all part time, so we'd no premises of our own. So it was all just going in the evening time, setting up rooms, conducting classes, and then taking all the equipment out and then going home at night time.
Okay.
Like, it was absolutely crazy. As I said, we had those 1,000 kids in our third year, and like, we were on it on the go 5 nights a week. So Monday to Friday and Saturday morning. So myself and the lads, we'd literally get up at 9 in the morning, I'd get into the office for 9, we'd work all day getting stuff ready, and then you'd have to work till 9, half 9 at night.
But 1,000 kids, you must have been just ecstatic, like.
Yeah.
Probably too tired to be ecstatic, but you must have been kind of wondering what the hell is going on.
It was like a whirlwind, and there was no time to stop and think. Like, the phone was hopping off the hook, and we were still literally with a mobile phone dealing and administrating all these 1,000 students. We were working off Excel sheets, but we had no CRM, we had no nothing, and like, it was actually very, very stressful. And I remember once we kind of got to the 1,000 student mark, we had to go out and hire 4 or 5 people. Wow. To help us, and we literally had no choice. We had to hire, I think it was 2 people to answer the phone. We had to hire 2 guys to like just help lift stuff. Like, it was unbelievable. Like, we were going into venues at 5 p.m. in the evening. We'd set up for a class at 5:30. When I say going into venues, we would rock into a hotel, the Slorgan Park Hotel near the Talbot, and they would go, They give us an empty room. We'd have to bring in all the chairs, the tables, the whiteboards.
That's a lot of work.
Set everything up. And there'd be two or three classes that night. And then we'd have to take everything down and bring it all away. We had vans on the go. Like, it was just crazy. Like, it was kind of all over the place. The thing that was good was, from the facade, we had great teachers, we had classrooms, we had students that were very happy. But behind it, my God, it was just chaos.
I think that's like any young grown business, though. You're patching it together as it goes because it never like comes out fully formed.
It was like a Frankenstein, which was bits just stuck onto it, and people doing mad jobs, and it was all over the place. But you know, as kind of we kind of got out of the the mist then in kind of our fourth and fifth year, and we kind of we had more kind of defined systems in place. We had kind of an administration department, we had our operations department, we had our marketing department. We had to hire a guy in to do marketing for us because we were doing it all ourselves at the time.
Did you get an office at this stage?
And we
or
got an office.
Location or what did you do?
So literally, as I said, we used the Slorgan Park Hotel for many years, about 3 to 4 years we used that. So we rented an office next door to it, literally. So we could walk out the door and we were in the hotel.
Excellent.
And that worked really, really well. And as I said, you know, we kind of got a little bit more formal. We, we had departments. People kind of started to know their jobs. We got a phone system in, which was
a real
dream.
One.
As in, like, there was several lines at once, so you could have three people on the phone at once. And this was mind blowing for us. Because anytime you'd ring the Dublin School of Maths, which became the Dublin School of Grinds, actually, when I didn't mention that. You get an engaged dial tone because the phone was always on the off, like, was off the hook. So we kind of got a bit more formal, which was great. And then eventually the hotel turned around to us and said, okay, guys, you know, we're had enough of you guys. Your students are coming in. They're kind of taking over the place and they're not buying any food.
Right.
They're not, you know, buying coffees or teas. So we're not getting the passing trade from you. So I see your rent there. Yeah, that's doubly.
Wow.
So they doubled our rent overnight and we kind of had no choice but to pay it because where are we going to go?
And they probably knew that as well.
Oh,
they knew they kind of had
They knew.
Probably business was starting to pick up for them coming out of the recession as well.
It was indeed. And do you know what? I don't blame them. I never once blamed them.
It's not personal, it's business.
It's business and I don't disagree with them.
Yeah.
And they did that. But we knew then that we had to get out of the hotel.
Okay.
And we walked across the road to the primary school, Oakland's primary school, and it was perfect. The place was a dream. And we said to them, you know, your classrooms are empty from 2 p.m. in the evening. They're empty, so can we take them over in the evening? And they were delighted. They thought this was fantastic. You know, we're going to get all this extra rental income and we don't do anything for it. So we took over the school the following year, moved into the school. Things were going great. The rent was much more reasonable. There was loads of parking. It was fantastic. And, we, you know, at this point, we had about 2,500 students a week coming through the doors and we were flying. It was going great. And then the neighbours started to complain. So the neighbours beside the school, well, particularly one or two neighbours, started to go ballistic about traffic. And again, I don't blame them. There was a lot of cars in the evening coming through the doors.
Wow.
And then they started to get very vocal about it. They started to write letters saying that, you know, it's not fair and, you know, you shouldn't be allowed to use the school and it's too intense a use of it and there's traffic in the evenings. And they were making a complaint then to the county council about it, saying that it wasn't right that we were there at the evening time. And the county council eventually said, no, they're a school as well.
Yeah.
Their education. There's no issue with...
It's not like it's a concert or whatever. You can kind of...
Yeah, you know, it's a school. It's extra revenue for the school.
Yeah.
It's not a...
Service to the local community.
Service
local ticks
community,
all the boxes.
All of that. And then the county council sided with us. That was great. But one of the neighbours, or two of them, as I said, were very, very passionate about this kind of issue, let's say. And they took it all the way to on board Planola, which is like the High Court of the planning world. And we were like, we're golden here. You know, the county council are siding with us. Like, we're helping community, yada, yada, yada. And I remember on the eve of the school starting for our next academic year, board Planola said, no, you're right, actually. They should leave. That's intensification of use of that school. So they got to go. And we were literally about to start the school for the, I think it was in our seventh year.
Wow.
And we'd no home.
How long were you given to get out?
2 weeks.
Wow.
2 weeks. So this was probably the tail end of August. And we were doing all of our free courses kind of at the end of August.
We kept that going every year.
Yeah, kept that going. It worked really, really well. It still works. And tail end of August, the planner said, you can do your free courses, but once the 1st of September hits, you're out of there. And we like, at this point, you know, we were spending maybe 60 grand on marketing, you know, for those, just those courses alone. And the flyers had gone out with pictures of the school, the address of the school.
Oh, no.
Like, this is where we are, yada, yada, yada. And we had no home. And I remember me and the two lads were just like in a crisis room, like, you know, war room with like stuff on the walls, trying to figure out what are we going to do. And we literally picked up the phone to as many principals as we knew. And by some miracle, within 3 days, we called lots of people. Within 3 days, we'd managed to get two new schools to rent us space within 3 days, which is very quick, because schools usually take ages to make decisions because of their boards and they've got all sorts of red tape you have to go through. But we moved from Stillorgan, Oaklands, to two other schools in Dublin. Okay. And just about scraped out of that one there. But at the, we realised then that, okay, now, and luckily we didn't really lose that many students. There are a couple of people who are a bit annoyed about it, but ultimately it was okay, you know. But we realised, okay, we've got a massive problem here. Mm-hmm. We have a massive problem. Our business, our school, has a massive issue in it. We have one degree of failure here around our venue. Okay, and every single startup, every single business is, you know, has, can potentially face this issue. Like, for example, like our business was hanging by one thread, and that thread was being held by landlords. Mm. Okay, and what happened was that thread was cut on us. Now, luckily, we managed to salvage it, but we said we got to get our own venue. We have to get our own dedicated premises, or else, you know, we're going to face this issue again. And no, we got away with it this time, but we might not the next time. So we spent about 2 years going through planning applications for various buildings. That's very hard to find space in South Dublin, particularly when the market started to get
What year are we talking about now?
So this would have been about 2014-ish, about, yeah, about 2013, so 2014.
Things are starting to turn up again, things are starting to move.
Okay. Absolutely, yeah. So we had planning applications in on four places, Mount Marion, Black Rock, Dean's Grange, and I think one other one as well, and all four of those either failed in planning or we pulled because we realised they weren't the right place for us.
Okay. And what were you looking for?
We were looking for, well, first of all, it had to be educationally zoned or have educational use on it, because you can't operate without the right use. But obviously more important than that even is the location. So we needed to be somewhere in the middle of South Dublin that was very, very accessible. One of the reasons why people like coming to us in, you know, in our other venues was we were right on the N11, big bus corridor, a lot of people can get to you, it's very easy and convenient. So it had to be somewhere around like the Stillorgan, Black Rock, Marion, Dean's Grange was a little bit south for us. And I remember a to let sign went up on this building. So where we are right now, it's where the Stillorgan Cinema is, above the Lidl. And I remember seeing a to let sign went up. And I was like, that would be perfect. It's right across from where we used to be in the hotel and the primary school in Oaklands. And I called up the estate agent, went, met him. He showed me around. And literally one of the first things out of his mouth was, how old are you?
Really?
I was like, you know, about 27, 28. And he's like, right, okay. And you just need to tell straight away, the guy thought I was some messer, some young fella, didn't have a clue what he was doing. And
it's a big building. I think we were talking about this earlier. It's very deceptive from the outside. It just looks like it's one kind of couple of rooms from the outside as you're driving by, but it's huge. What square footage is it?
So it's 18,500 square feet. So, you know, for kind of perspective, you know, it's about the size of a supermarket, you know, give or take. You're kind of medium size Tesco or whatever. It's so it's quite a significant amount of space. I mean, this estate agent didn't take it seriously whatsoever, and he wasn't getting back to me. He was like, ah, no, you know, not interested.
He knew what you were looking for, and he was,
yeah, he showed me around, but I knew he just wasn't taking it seriously. So I figured out who owned the building, did a bit of research, and found the guy's name, and a bit of detective work, got his number, and I called him up. I said, how's it going? My name's Chris. I see your building's to let. I'd love to rent it from you. I'm not hearing back from the estate agent, but could I come and meet you? He said, absolutely. How's tomorrow at 2:00? I drove down to his office.
A ballsy move, like, yeah. It's, you know.
Yeah, I drove down to his office. He was an incredibly nice guy. I told him the whole story. I said, this is what we've done, and this is what we want to do. This is where we want to go. And he really loved it. He thought it was a great idea. He wanted to support it. And he just said goodbye to the estate agent. He left the picture. And I negotiated with his people. And it took about 6 months, but we signed a contract. We went for planning, got it. And we were in then. In May 2017, we literally got the keys to the place. We'd done a massive fit out on it. I got to get a bit of finance for that from the old banks, which was great. They actually backed us this time.
They were more receptive.
Exactly, yeah. So we moved in then in May 2017 and we had our own place and we were delighted. And it was funny, actually, I did mention that I'd been working on it with two guys, Brian and Tom, up to this point. We were 7-8 years in and they kind of turned around and said, do you know what, Chris, we want to do something new. We want to part ways and go in our own direction. And I was like, okay, great. And we came up with a deal to do that. And I remember we were actually in a pub at the time. We went to the Goat for lunch, right? They do an
all good deals are done.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember that we were having lunch and they wrote down on a napkin, they go, okay, you know, this is what we want to exit. And I looked at it and I go, wow, that's not something I have.
Was this around the same time as you were thinking about moving?
Yeah, so this was all happening at the time we were getting the lease for this place, which was a 20-year lease we were signing. So, you know, I was thinking about that, you know, committing to the next 20 years at this, and the lads want to move on to something else. So anyway, they wrote down this number, and I was thinking, wow, that's a lot. And I kind of said, okay, I'll get back to them. And I went away, and I just digested it for a number of days, and I said, okay, I'm fairly comfortable with that. And said, okay, we need to get someone in here to invest. Okay, I don't have the ability to fulfill this. But rather than just go off and get, you know, money from someone who just has it, some high net worth individual or a bank, we wanted to get an investor who was a strategic partner in this. So somebody not only who had capital, which is what we needed, but more important than that, they had know-how. They had experience in the industry, they had contacts, they had kind of bandwidth, you know, someone that could come in and go, okay, let's turn the dials up on this, and, you know, someone who can help bring it to the next level. So I remember the three of us actually wrote a list of 30 people who we kind of knew from the 7 or 8 years we've been in the industry. People like CEOs of publishing companies, you know, people who we knew owned other schools or private schools or colleges, and that list had 30 people on it, and we systematically went through every single one of those people, sent them emails to say, look, you know, it's funny actually, we couldn't really say what we were doing, but we said we wanted to kind of get out there and meet more people in the industry, this is our story, collaborate maybe, and kind of get to know each other. And you'd be surprised the amount of people that wrote back to us, almost all of them said, oh yeah, come in for a coffee and have a chat.
You'd established your reputation at this stage. Yeah, so you were a serious player. You weren't just going to waste their time.
Exactly. It wasn't just a totally cold call. Like they kind of would look us up and say, okay, these guys might be interesting to talk to.
Was it hard to not show your hand too much to a potential competitor as well? Was that very difficult not Absolutely. So it wouldn't get out there?
Absolutely. And this industry, everybody knows everything. Mm. And particularly our competitors know everything about us, and us to the same degree about them. But we were quite cute about how we went about it. The first, say, when we met all the 30 or so people, we didn't really give it away in the first meeting. Right, so we met all 30 of them, and then afterwards, it kind of, I was thinking, okay, well, I liked him, I liked her, like them, and then we'd go meet them again, and we kind of filtered them down, and in the second meeting, go, okay, would you be interested in becoming an investor in the school? And then we actually got to the point where we got down to one guy, and he was just the perfect partner, and spent about 6 to 9 months kind of negotiate. He was in and interested, and we spent about 6 to 9 months negotiating with this guy who was, you know, quite a well-known investor in education in Ireland, and he'd owned numerous kind of colleges and language schools, and was just really connected to the industry, and he was the perfect partner. And took about, as I said, 6 to 9 months, and eventually we signed the deal. The two lads got their exit, and I went to the business with a new partner who was kind of, let's say, non-exec, not here every day, but there once a month, board meetings and stuff to help and give contacts when they're needed. So what was interesting was we had this new building, we had a new strategic partner, and we had a plan then to bring it to the next level. So up until this point, we're about 8 years in at this point, 7 years in at this point, right? And we'd just been doing part-time courses, right? And we had this 18,000 square foot building here, empty from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Nothing. Okay. The place a ghost town. And we said, okay, you know, part of the plan here is to start our own full-time school from, you know, for fifth and sixth year, similar to what our, you know, our competitors do. And we put a plan in place to hire teachers to leave their jobs, their state paid jobs, lovely pension jobs, to come and work for us full time. And because we had about 30 teachers working for us in the evening times, we approached 10 of them and said, do you want to leave your school and work for us full time? And all 10 of them said yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, it was a function of a couple of things. It was a function of, you're only teaching fifth and sixth years, which is nice for a teacher. You're teaching students that want to work hard academically, which is always good. Mm. It's like teaching, you know, if you're teaching a rugby team or coaching a rugby team, if you're coaching the first, the seniors, it's a little bit more interesting than coaching the first years. You know, people are more driven, yeah, you know, there to do well and so on. But then third, economically, they could make more money working here than they could in the state system. So All 10 of those teachers left their posts and joined us full time. And then we had to like market this school. So it's very weird marketing a secondary school from the ground up. What do you do? It's one of those things, like, I don't think anyone has ever sat in a boardroom and said, oh, how do you launch a school?
Yeah, that's why I was so interested to chat to you, because I've met lots of people who've started, you know, food brands and different tech companies, things like that. Yeah. But starting a school, it must have, I know you had experience 7 or 8 years in, but like, it must have been massively daunting.
It was. It was also like, this is not a clue what to do. Like, how do you market, you know, a secondary school? It's just a strange thing. And now, as I said, you know, we'd had a bit of reputation. At this point, we had about 3,000 students a week coming to the grinds. Okay? So, like, we weren't exactly nobodies in South Dublin. But still, to get somebody to leave their school and come to you full-time, it's a big commitment.
Huge.
It's a big, big commitment. And the way I looked at it was, like, and Jordan Belfort talks about this, like, every sale is a straight line from A to B. Okay. And my theory was, for someone to go from thinking about moving school to moving school entirely, let's say from A to B, they're going to have a lot of unknowns they have to resolve along the way. Okay. So, i.e., like, you know, how much is the school? That's one of them. They have to find that out. Why is this school different to where I am at the moment? Who are the people behind the school? What is their reputation like? Who are the teachers? What kind of approach do you take to assessment? All of these things are unknowns that people have that you got to answer, right? So the way I saw it was, you bring a customer on a journey, a potential customer on a journey, answer all the unknowns as they arise, and bring them back to the kind of the path where they sign up to a student, right? So I hope this makes sense. If I had a whiteboard, I'd be able to show you, but we're on a podcast, so I can't. But no worries. So we designed this process, right? This kind of, let's say, a funnel, okay? And the funnel had a number of stages in it, okay? Like, there's a great book called 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. One of those habits is you always start with the end in mind, okay? And we said to ourselves, we want to start the school with 150 students in our first year, the full-time school, 150 students, 50 in fifth year and 100 in sixth year. So for students, they could join fifth and sixth year, as in they could do fifth year and do sixth year with us, or they could just do sixth year and go on, if that makes sense. So we wanted to have 50 and 100 in each of those years. And that was like the end point. So we had to work back from that. How do you get 150 people to sign up? And we designed a kind of process that we'd bring them through that would answer all of these unknowns and then arrive at a point where 150 of them were happy enough to commit to it. So the process went a little bit something like this, starting at the first step. Now, we had to, first of all, on our website, have a lot of information about how the school was going to work, you know, basic stuff, right? And the whole idea was they would come on the website, they would read about the school, and then on the website we would invite them to an open evening, right? And that open evening, so let's just say you had 2,000-3,000 people come on the website, read all that content. We were hoping that, let's say, 600 of them would come, sign up for an open night, give us their details, their name, their email, their home address, and then come to an open night or register for an open night. Okay, so that was that was the second step. Come on the website, step one. Step two, register for an open night, okay? Then actually turn up at the open night's another one as well. You'll always see a drop off there. You know, it's like you register for a free seminar.
Yeah.
you know,
or something else comes up,
a free, you know, webinar. You know, you obviously not everybody goes to them. So anyway, for those who did come to the open night, this whole idea was get them into the building, get them in to see the place. Just like, you know, you came in here this morning, we did a tour of the place first, give a bit of context, where are we, and it kind of helped paint the picture. At that open night then, we had five speakers. Okay, five speakers, and those speakers were from different areas in the school. So the first one was me. I stood up, I told them about the background of the school, how we got to where we are, the importance of great teaching, how we hired teachers, and all of that good stuff. Then our principal stood up and talked about how the school was going to work operationally, you know, how the assessment works, how discipline, which isn't an issue, how that might work, how study works, and so on. Then we had two of our teachers stand up. So we had two of our kind of star teachers show how they would teach maths or Irish. Mm. And the whole idea is that parents and students can see firsthand, whoa, this person's exciting.
Mm.
And then finally, we'd have a student stand up. So a student that had been through the grinds with us.
Okay.
Someone who could vouch for, you know, their experience, vouch for the teachers and how great they were and say how it helped them. So let's say we got 300 or 400 people to open nights. From open nights, then we'd invite them to a one-on-one meeting.
Okay.
So if they liked what they saw at the open night, come to us in a one-on-one meeting, and we'll sit down with you, and we'll answer any question you have about the school. Now, the good thing about the website started to answer questions. Then the open night answered more questions. Now the one-on-one meeting was to answer those specific bespoke questions.
So you had a very specific sales funnel. You approached it like a businessman. Just on that, it must be difficult to sell because you're selling to two different people. You're selling to the student who wants one thing and the parents who want another.
Absolutely. You are, big time, because what a student wants is very different to what a parent wants. Sometimes students just think it's great there's no uniform. You know. But now most students we get here would want a lot more than that. But parents want to know, as I said, they want to know who's behind the school. That was actually quite a big thing, and I would be the same. You know, who are these people? You know, and we'd have to explain our kind of background and, you know, how the school was structured and all of that. And they'd want to know more about the teachers. They want to know, like, how does your average day work? Kind of bits and bobs like that. But in these meetings was great because I got a chance to build that rapport with the parents and with the students, and we'd be able to answer those direct questions. So I remember before we launched school, full-time school, we did an ISAT in every single one of these meetings with our admissions director. We did 250, actually, we did almost 300 one-to-one meetings.
I was going to ask you, because time-wise alone, that's phenomenal.
It was incredibly time intensive.
And probably everyone wants the evening meetings as well. Yeah.
It was unbelievable.
How did you balance that?
It was over 9 months.
Okay.
And like we mapped it all out that we knew we'd have to do about, you know, 250, 300 meetings based on the funnel that we were kind of, now we didn't get it exactly right, but we estimated about 250, 300 and wasn't actually far off that. And literally sat in everyone. And I wanted to sit in every one of those meetings and run them because I wanted to learn what is it that parents want?
Free market research.
Market research. Yeah. What is it that students want? And it was amazing what we picked up. And every time we did a meeting, we got better at the next meeting because we're like, okay, we shouldn't have said that, or we need to focus more on this.
Yeah.
Our process refined as we went. You know, it was really, really, really sharp by the end of it. And the funny thing was, we were hoping for 150 students. Like, we hit 150 pretty early on, you know, about 3 months before the school was launching.
Really?
So, yeah. And so we actually
went. Was it hard to convince people? I know in terms of you'd had a huge track record with grinds, but in terms of this being the first time ever someone came in at 9 o'clock on a Monday morning and sat down and were like, right, let's go.
Absolutely. Like, massively so. But our kind of attitude was, it was if we take massive action, massive, you know, considered action towards this and really go for it and trust our instincts. And that's what we were using. Like, there was no real manual for how to market a school. There was no, you know, preordained path of this is how it should be done.
Yeah.
We just had to use our instincts and, like, just think about it logically. You know, if someone's going to sign up to school, they want loads of questions to be answered for them. And that's the same every, and this is the thing that Jordan Belfort, I'm not a massive fan of Jordan Belfort, to be honest with you. However, he does say some interesting things that every sale is the same. Every sale involves resolving unknowns for a potential customer. If you can figure out what they want and answer all the questions along the way, you'll make the sale. And we just applied that kind of principle and got volume through the door. And what was good was, because we had so many people we were interviewing, we could be a little bit selective about who we took into the school as well. which was great. You know, we didn't want to take in students that didn't want to be there.
Mm.
You know, one of the primary factors for us in accepting a student is their attitude, because attitude is everything. We don't necessarily want all the 600 pointers. We want the students who are there because they want to be there and they want to better themselves, and they make the best students.
It's almost like hiring someone.
Exactly. It's all about attitude. And in life, it's all about attitude. And you can get kids who are super, super bright, but they don't kind of want to be there. They're not bothered trying. And, you know, they don't always do well in an environment like this. So we started our first year with just over 200 students. And we literally went through the whole year. And I say, it was a struggle. It wasn't easy. You know, doing the grinds is one thing, because they're in for 75 minutes the evening and they're gone. But in the day school, they're there, you know, from 9 till 5 a day, you know, for 5 days.
It must have multiplied, you know, the contact hours and everything by 1,000. You know, so many other issues that are now popping up.
Unbelievable amount of issues.
What were the initial kind of challenges in the first couple of weeks or months?
It was probably managing the stress levels of students, because, you know, when you come to a new environment like this, you're kind of thrown into, you know, disarray a little bit, because everything's new. And then, like, the pace here, it's not, you know, it's not aggressively academic and fast, but the teachers here are unbelievably driven, organized and dedicated, and they don't waste a moment in class. And there's not much dossing that can happen here. You can't just coast. If you're coasting here, you kind of get caught up in it.
Okay. And not
in a bad way, in a supportive way. And I think some students were kind of adjusting to that, and like managing that was a challenge. You know, we got there in the end. Also, we definitely miscalculated how much we needed in terms of resources for administration. We only had a principal working on his own. He didn't have a deputy. Okay. He didn't have a secretary. So, you know, he was chasing himself, you know, chasing his tail a lot. And, you know, it was a lot of kind of all of us working late nights and stuff. But we figured out what didn't work. And it's amazing, like, by doing, you learn what you're not doing right, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And by basically running a school and opening your doors, you'd realise pretty damn quick where you're missing skills, resources, or, you know, you're just not doing a good enough job. And it's very hard to forecast some of these things. It's only when you're in it that you realise, oh God, we got to adapt, we got to change things, we got to tweak things. And we're now in our second year of the full-time school, and like, we are our finger on the pulse with everything here. We've got the right amount of people doing the right jobs at the right time, fulfilling the right roles, and so on and so forth. And things are running a lot smoother for us now, which I'm happy to say. But it wasn't an easy road. It's just like you said there, contact hours went up big time. They did. Like, running a part-time grind school is a walk in the park compared to running a full-time school. There's a lot more going on. There's a lot of personalities. You know, people are people,
yeah,
and they're irrational.
To have 250 people in one building.
Yeah, there's a lot of emotions.
A lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, and the leaving.
Especially at that age.
Absolutely. It's at that age, combine that with the leaving cert, like, there's a lot of, you know, it's a tough time. And but you know, we've learned a hell of a lot from doing that. And that only came from doing.
You know, if you were starting again now in the morning, what would you change?
That's such an interesting question. What would I change? Okay, well, first thing is, I think I'll give it kind of a cliche answer. I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change a thing, because it's only by going through crap and going through adversity and going through tough times that you grow as a person and you gain skills. You know, we have a saying here that we use all the time, is never waste a good crisis, okay? When shit happens, it's an old Chinese proverb, when shit happens, excuse my French, when shit happens, there is an opportunity to grow from it, big time. We are our best when our backs are against the wall. And any time, looking back in hindsight, where stuff blew up in our face, and it happened many times, and the venue thing was one of those examples. If it wasn't for that, we wouldn't have had the get up and go to get this place.
Yeah.
And it's looking, you know, adversity, there's always opportunity to grow and flip it on its head and go, okay, you know, how do we turn this around and make it towards our advantage? You know, if something bad happens, and it will, if you're starting a business, it's not going to be rosy. And if it is, there's a problem. If everything's going your way, I would be shit scared.
You haven't started yet
because it's all going to go wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, and you know, you have to realize that there's a reason why I read this only the other day, 96% of businesses fail in their first 10 years. And a lot of people, I think, go into business and they don't really think that, you know, the longer I'm in this industry, the more likely it is that I fail, which is crazy. And you want to be a bit mad to set up a business because, you know, it's like being a gladiator. The longer you're a gladiator, the more likely you're going to die in the ring. And it's the same business. Look at Lehman Brothers.
Yeah.
They were 100 years in business. Mm. If you combined all of their revenues together, it would be $1 trillion with a T. And yet, in 2008, gone.
Gone, yeah.
And if I was going back to give myself advice, you know, I would say some things. I would be, you know, definitely find more balance. You know, I think there's this mentality with the likes of a Gary Vaynerchuk that, you know, get on the grind, man. What are you doing from 7 till 2 in the morning? Yeah. You know, grind away. I don't buy into any of that. Mm. I think that is just hyperbole. I think it is crazy. I think if you can't get what you need to get done in a reasonable working week, then you're doing something wrong. Yeah. I think you're like going into a forest with a blunt axe and you're trying to chop trees down. Mm. You need to stop, you need to sharpen the axe, sharpen the saw. And, you know, what I mean by that is you need to reflect, okay, I'm spending countless hours on something here. I need to go in and relook at my approach. And I need to be more efficient with my time. Because if you try and burn the candle at both ends, you can do it while you're young. Certainly you can. You can get away with it. But there will be, you know, a payoff period where you've got to, you know, you got to pay back with interest, you know, what you borrowed. And the borrowed, what I mean by that is time.
Yeah.
And I think a lot, I was working crazy hours. Now, in fairness, in many ways, it got us to where we are. But I would say, you know, you got to focus more on your strategy and your mindset rather than just grinding. Mm. Because I was working till, you know, very late at night with the lads, and we're getting nothing done.
Yeah,
you know, you're looking at a screen.
I agree with you completely. It gets to a certain point in the day, just you're doing nothing. You're there in body, and you're just digging a hole and filling it in again. There's no productivity.
Yeah. It's like this law of diminishing returns. You know, you would be better off going for a walk in a forest.
Going to the gym, having a sleep, coming back in the next morning, getting it all done in 4 hours.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, students, I remember when I was in college, as I said, I never went to lectures because they were so boring. Sorry, excuse me, I don't mean to be rude or ignorant. I didn't, engage with the content. It wasn't floating my boat. So what I would do is I would study all night, like most college students do before an exam, not go to sleep, go in and attempt to do an exam, thinking that was the way to do it.
Yeah.
It does not work. Okay. Something I've learned now is a book called Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. Fantastic book.
I've heard great things. Is it good?
It's phenomenal. Okay. It is phenomenal. One of the things I'm most religious about in my life is sleep. If I don't get 8 hours sleep a night, between 7 and 8 hours, it's usually 7 hours a night, I just don't function properly. And you need sleep for lots of reasons. It helps you transport memories from short term to long term, you know, which is really, really important. It helps to regulate your mood and it keeps you healthy as well. And definitely going back, giving myself advice, I'd be like, sleep more, relax more, you know, refresh. Don't be wasting your time, you know, looking at, you know, stuff when you're not being productive. Like, sharpen the saw, you know, work on your mindset. Because something that Tony Robbins, who's a big hero of mine, says is that success is 80% psychology and 20% mechanics. So 80% what you think and your mindset, and 20% what you do. So the strategies you implement, the actions you take, and the interactions you have. And a lot of people think that it's just action, action, action. And it is. Action's a massive part of it. But it's also like, it's with the right psychology, you're going to take determined, consistent action.
Action at the right time. Action in the right way. Yeah.
Right time, right way, and so on and so forth. And psychology is just so, so important. And what I'd say to myself is immerse yourself in books about psychology as much as you can. Talk to people with great psychologies, because psychology in business is everything. It's mindset. It's so, so important. It's funny. Do you ever hear people say, you know, oh, I started a business, but, you know, failed because, you know, I just didn't have enough money. Ran out of money.
Yeah.
Or, no, it failed because I didn't have the right contacts. Or it failed, you know, I just didn't have the right people. Or, you know, the clients, they just weren't good, you know. And all of that is bullshit. The reason those companies failed was nothing to do with those. Their resources, okay? The reason those companies failed was because the entrepreneur, the leader, was not resourceful, okay? Resourcefulness is the ultimate resource, right? And the most powerful resource we have available to us is emotional states. Okay, what do I mean by emotional states? It's if you have enough, okay, can you get something done if you have enough creativity, decisiveness, determination, passion. Get up and go. Can you get something done if you have enough of that? Well, I think you could.
Yeah.
And I think people kind of criticize or condemn or complain about why they're not where they want to be. And I say, it's not what's outside, it's what's inside that's holding you back.
It's fear as well. I think fear is a huge part of it.
It's fear. Absolutely. Yeah. It's fear of being judged by others. It's, you know, if I put myself out there, it's not going to, and if it doesn't go well, people will think I'm, you know, useless. You know,
I chat to a lot of people about business and stuff, and a lot of people are like, oh, I want to start my business, but.
But.
I always get that. I want to start my business, but. I was like, but, you know, just start.
Yeah.
You know, it's all about. It's like we used it earlier, the only way is just to start, because it'll go wrong.
Yeah.
But so what? What's the worst case scenario?
Yeah.
Just start again.
I think that's such a powerful question. What's the worst thing that can happen?
Yeah.
And
you got to go there. Yeah. You got to go, right, okay, you want to start the business, right, okay, great. What's the best case? What's the worst case?
Yeah.
If you landed somewhere in the middle, would you be happy? Of course.
Of course you would.
Well then.
Yeah.
Worst case scenario, have a plan for the worst case. Great. But then also know where you're going to. I loved your thing about starting at the end.
Yeah.
That's superb, because then you know exactly the steps. Yeah. I think not enough people do that.
No, absolutely not. And I think that's a really powerful thing, is what is the worst that could happen? And in reality, it's usually fine. Yeah. And if you can accept worst case scenario, the only thing that can happen is something better than that, usually. As you said, you land in the middle there. But I think what's also very important, and touching on what you said there, is this starting with the end in mind. I think a lot of people go in to business and they don't really know what the vision is, okay? And in business, you need to have a very clear, it's you want in anything in life.
Yeah.
Anything in life. You need a very clear vision as to what does success look like? What does this look like in 5 years? Because, you know, you need to have, you're not going to be able to get there on your own, okay? And if you've got a very compelling vision, people follow people who know where they're going, right? And if you have a very clear vision as to what you want to achieve, you're making an exciting journey and you're passionate, you've linked very strong reasons as to why you want to achieve that vision and why it's important to you. For example, for me, it was when the business, family business went under. I was like, okay. And I almost without realizing at the time, that was really the drive. That was the fuel and the engine for me to get out there and just make something happen and do anything. And I think if you've got compelling reasons to achieve that vision, people will look at that and they go, geez, that's interesting. You know, that guy or girl is trying to do something that sounds exciting. I want to be part of that. And you have to have a very clear vision. That's not just general. Like people say, oh, I want to make more money.
Yeah, I'd like to. Yeah, it's so funny when I talk to people, friends of mine who are in careers, in kind of air quotes, and they're like, "Oh yeah, I just want to get the next promotion." I was like, "Why?" "Oh, I just like to make a bit more money." I was like, "Why?" And it's just it's because the psychology of big companies are very clever in terms of, oh, this is, you want to get to, I was like a mate of mine, I was like, oh, you want to get to Autotron 2000, you know, it's all like, but why? You know, more money because what? Oh, so I can go on more holidays, but you've gone on like 5 this year. Oh, but, you know, it rationalized, it's like you were talking about earlier, you rationalize backwards often. You know, you rationalize what happened to you and you rationalize, oh, that must happen because I did this.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, instead of starting at the end going, oh, this is what I want to, where I want to go.
Absolutely. And I think what's interesting is, why do people want more money? I think it's ridiculous. They don't want more money. They want what they think the money is going to give them.
Bingo.
They want what they think the money is going to get them. Is it going to get them more holidays? Is it going to get them more respect in the workplace? Is it going to get them, like, can they buy that car they've always wanted to buy? The funny thing is, none of that stuff makes you happy. Okay. But ultimately, like, what does make people happy? And I believe that it's progress. It's progress in anything.
Yeah.
Okay. And that could be progress in getting better at to-doings, honestly. But it depends what you like and what you love. But definitely, you know, more money doesn't make people happy. I can tell you, though, if you feel like you're progressing in anything, you'll feel alive. And if you're not going forward, you're not improving, you're going backwards. And I think if people just focus on getting better and improving in any way, like, that will ultimately give them the unhappiest that they're looking for. If that makes sense.
I've chatted to a good few people in the last kind of couple of months who've been sports people or played sport to a reasonable level, and it transfers incredibly well to business. And it's exactly what you just said there. It's because they know, okay, if I train 3 times this week, I'll get a little bit better. The reward is we win the match, or I win my boxing match, whatever it is. And then they transfer that brilliantly to business because they approach it like that. well, I just got to put in this much this week. I got to do these things. And their time is broken out into, right, goals, specific end, outcome, start, yeah, middle, end.
So true. And like it's funny. It's just the framework of doing anything in sport applies to business. So,
yeah,
you know, in such a parallel, because you've got an outcome, you've got activity that needs to happen to achieve the outcome. You break things down into bite-sized chunks, which is, you know, a very important thing people talk about is chunking. It's like, don't try and climb Mount Everest. Try get to base camp one, then to base camp two and three and four, and then hit the peak. And it's also in sport requires discipline. It requires, you know, having great habits. It's like turning up on time, you know, being prepared, being organized, and all of those things transfer over to business. And particularly, more important than any of those, I would say, is leadership skills. You know, you can learn so much on a pitch about leading people and building rapport with people and kind of uniting everybody towards a common goal. And in business, if you can't do that, you don't stand a chance. If you want to be an entrepreneur, you have to be able to lead people and get them excited about something and build rapport with them. And rapport building is one of the number one skills. If you were to ask me a question, what is the one skill an entrepreneur needs? I would say communication skills. Because unless you're able to, first of all, if you've got a great idea, that's great. But if you can't communicate that idea to your team and then to the marketplace, the idea will die on your lips. It's just not going to go anywhere. And communication skills are essential for that. Like one of the things I did was I read as many books as I could on communication, you know, trying to figure, and it's a skill. Communication skill. People think that some people are just born with confidence.
Yeah, that's a great excuse as well. Somebody, oh, he's just great at that.
Oh, I'm just shy. Yeah, yeah, he's just lucky. Or he's just brilliant at chatting to people. No, it's rubbish. When I was in school, I was shy. I was definitely more introvert than anything else. And I came out of school. I got set up this business. I didn't really know what we were doing. But I immersed myself in learning about communication. I read books. I used to be terrified of public speaking. Public speaking scared the bejesus out of me. And I said, okay, I've got to get over this fear. And I went to a Dale Carnegie public speaking course, 2 full days. It was €1,200, massive investment. It was the greatest €1,200 I ever spent in my life. And since then, I've probably done over 100 public speaking engagements between like just talking to the students or at a conference or something like that. And developing communication skills were essential to being able to get the skills to this point. We have 60 staff now, and you need to be able to talk to them.
Yeah,
you know, if you want them to do something.
It's probably the most overlooked thing, though. Communication. Totally. People just assume, oh, I talk every day. Yeah. You know what I mean? I love the fact that you're like, need to get better at this.
Yeah.
Invested in it. I think that's big as well. When you actually put money on the line with something, it changes how you think about it.
Yeah, totally. And you said something so interesting there. Sure, I talk every day. And people think that's communication. I can tell you that that's about 30% of communication. Yeah. Do you know what the other 70% is? Listening. Mm. And people do not know how to listen. Like if you've got your team of people and they're giving you feedback and you're not hearing it, you know, or you might be hearing it, but you're not comprehending it. Mm. Or if you've got to resolve conflict, listening is much more important than talking. Because God gave you 2 ears and 1 mouth for a reason. And a lot of people don't. I listen enough. But certainly communication, not to go off on too much of a tangent about it, is one of those things I would encourage people to look at. And it's something that you work your whole life on. Like I'm only on step one of 100 in terms of trying to improve how I communicate with others.
That growth mindset as well is something that comes across from yourself and a lot of entrepreneurs who are excellent is that continually learning. They're not just like, oh, I've done the Dale Carnegie course. Well, now I'm a great communicator.
Absolutely.
It's putting that in practice every single day. Yeah. I have 2 final questions for you and we'll wrap up because your time is precious. The last one you can think about for a minute, although I know from following the Instagram, it's not going to be a problem in terms of recommending a book.
Okay.
Each week we recommend a book and we give it away then that this week. So you can think about that for a minute. What do you do in terms of, you're obviously extremely busy, just from walking through your school here, there's so much happening and it's just a huge commitment in your second year. How do you plan, you know, your week, your quarter, your year? Is there specific things you do?
So I would say we probably plan things a year, two years in advance in terms of like, what are the overall goals in terms of revenues and how do we break those down into actual metrics of students and so on and so forth. And so we probably have like an overall scheme of a 2-year plan, but then we break that down into quarters. And those quarters, then the way we work with those is we have a board of the school here, which I meet every month, and then we see where we're getting, how we're getting on with, you know, those objectives that we set, our 2-year plan. For example, one of the 2-year plans was to start a full-time school and get it to a certain point, get it to this many students. And now we're working on our next 2-year plan, which is open another school on the north side. So, like, for example, that's another thing. But then we chunk those things down into quarters, and then we chunk those things down into months and then into weeks. But, like, I would say I spent a lot of my time organizing my week. So what I have is, like, my iPhone, I've got my calendar, and every minute on that calendar is planned out to a T. You know, I know what the quarterly objectives are. I know the 2-year plan. I know the quarterly objectives. I know the monthly objectives. And I then look at those each week. At the weekend, usually I'll have a look at them, and I'll plan my whole week then on a Sunday or a Saturday. And then in that week, then I stick to that plan kind of religiously, if that makes sense. Now, obviously, things come up and move around, but I would put the time in, and I'd probably, the night before I come into work, I'd probably jot down a couple of things on a notepad, maybe one or two things. And if I can get those things done in the day, I know it's successful. One of the things I learned, kind of like a life hack, was start with the toughest task first, okay? If you have to do something rotten, horrible, that's going to require a lot of mental energy, or something you just don't want to do, do it first in the day. Okay,
follow the frog.
Yeah. Do it first, and if you get nothing else done that day, then that's okay. Other things like batch tasking, as we talked about before the podcast, like try and batch task as much as you can. Batch task your emails is a massive thing. If you're sitting there trying to do work and your email is open and stuff pops in and out, you are going to be switch tasking all day. You're going to switch from whatever kind of report you're writing or whatever to writing back to somebody about some issue. And the amount of time it takes you to switch task, you would be amazed at. So just batch it, turn off email, turn off your phone, like focus on one thing at a time, and you'd be amazed at how quick you get things done. So that's kind of in a roundabout way what I do.
It's funny, all the simple advice is always the best. Literally, what you said there is exactly what James Brogan said last week, and it's exactly what about 10 people have said. Simple things. Just plan your week, have big goals, break them down into small goals, and then plan them out each week.
Absolutely. And like, simplicity is the key, right? The enemy to action is complexity. Okay, make things so simple that you cannot miss them.
Yeah. You talked about Gary Vaynerchuk earlier and all those guys, and because they work so well, because they're procrastination for people. They can watch them and think, oh, they must do. He's just about to reveal a silver bullet. He's just about to reveal that one thing that I'm not doing. Yeah. And it's nothing like that. It's just simple tasks broken down. Big tasks, small tasks, weekly tasks.
Yeah.
What book would you recommend that's had an impact on you?
This is a tough one for me.
Yeah, I'd say Turn and Arrow.
I might go through a few and then I'll recommend one.
But, yeah.
I'd say anything by Robert Kiyosaki. If you want to get into business, you need to know about finance. This guy has written the most popular finance book of all time, Rich Dad Poor Dad. I'd recommend reading as many of those books as you can. Anything by Tony Robbins, Waken the Giant Within in particular, is fantastic. That is a life-changing book. I had a paradigm shift in my kind of psychology after reading that and rereading it a couple of times. There's also things like Good to Great by Jim Collins, which is all about what's the difference between a good and a great company, or a company, how can a company go from good to great? Phenomenal book. There's one actually amazing book I read recently called Atomic Habits by James Clear.
It's a book that's had probably the biggest impact on me in the last 2 years.
It is amazing. It is so, so good. I devoured it in about 2 hours. So I was like, this is such a page turner. There's unbelievably good advice in there. One we actually recommended as well is Why We Sleep by Matthew Walker. That's an amazing book. I learned so much from that. But if I was to recommend one book, it is this one. And it's a book that every single entrepreneur has to read. And it's called The E-Myth by Michael E. Gerberger.
Yes.
The E-Myth. Yep. It is an essential piece of reading. Okay. It is so, so simple. It's so simple. But in it, within the pages of that book, will tell you why most businesses fail.
And I put it off reading it for so long. I put it off because I thought it was like, oh, it's just one of those books.
Yeah,
it's
it phenomenal. Is amazing. It's so, so good. Read it, reread it. It's all about, if you want to be an entrepreneur, like, you have to stand back from the business, you know, and you have to work on the business, not in the business. And a lot of people, you know, they're good at coding, let's say, and they want to start a, you know, something in tech, and they're amazing at coding, and they spend all their time coding at the laptop. But your business isn't going to go very far unless you're good at managing people, and you're good at getting finance in and managing finances, and then steering the ship you know, in terms of where this is going to go. So it kind of helps put things in perspective a lot. Like, for example, you know, I said work on the business, not in the business. Like, the captain of a ship doesn't spend his time down in the coal room shoveling coal into the fire. What's he doing? He's up on the deck. Yeah. He's looking at where the ship's going. There's other people doing that. And I think a lot of people, when they go into business, they like, for example, in the book, in the E-Myth, he talks about a lady who's passionate about baking pies, and she opens a pie shop and it all goes wrong because she thinks that baking pies is all you have to do. Mm. But to run a business, there's a whole myriad of activities that are required. So anyway, Michael E. Berger, Kerberger, The E-Myth, is a book I would recommend.
Perfect. Chris, we'll give that away. All people have to do to win is tag yourself. And what's the social handles for the Academy?
It's at Dublin Academy.
Brilliant. Perfect. Tag at Dublin Academy and tag myself and they can win a copy of that book.
Chris, thanks,
thank
Harry.
You so much.
Pleasure.
And that was episode 28 with Chris Lauder. If you want to win a copy of The E-Myth by Michael Gerber, it's a fantastic book. I can definitely highly recommend it also. You just simply have to tag Dublin Academy and Chris and myself on any social channel you like. Just please do make sure to tag us, otherwise we don't know you've entered. I will announce the winner next week. I will see you next Thursday at 6 a.m. for episode 29 with Mr. Luke Mackey of the Bamboo app. Talk to you then.